This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, which are run by Indiana Humanities and awarded every 2 years. We thought we'd come back to this series to offer up some holiday gift-giving ideas. This hour, we'll hear from the poets. First up is Calista Buchan. She's the author of the poetry collection Look, 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 which came out last fall. Calista Buchan, welcome to All In.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with a poem from the new collection, Look, Look, Look.
My book, my collection, is all about being a parent and about mothering, especially in those tough early years. So the poem that I'm going to read now is about being vulnerable and what it means to have children out in the world and understand the limits of the extent to which we can protect them. This is Tornado. I insist on a safe room. Something guaranteed to stand the wind. This is life on the prairie, I say. The men bring bolts, drive rebar through concrete. We make everything hard. The steel room out in the garage, loaded with gallons of water, the extra pairs of shoes, the threat. I know a mother who plans to tip the dryer over her children during a storm. What can I do, she says, and we all nod. The weather is easy enough. After the children are asleep, I make dinners for the week and freeze them. I refill the soap dispensers. I sort laundry as if I can hold back the threat. I curl against the tile floor in the kitchen and stay up late making lists, drawing maps. When I mistake the wind for a woman weeping, I wake the husband. Where can I get more steel? I ask him, my fingers on the baby's chest. Counting breaths.
Thank you for that. So the poems in this book, they're a little different from some of the poems that we've heard so far today. These are prose poems. How can prose be used as poetry?
I think that poetry is a wonderful medium and that it's really ecumenical. It welcomes everyone. And the prose poem in particular exists in a great liminal in-between space. It isn't a formal lined poem, but it isn't the story that a short story or a novel might be. It gets to exist in this weird little ditch between the two. And I think that's often the place where new and special and exciting things can happen. So for me, the prose poem was a perfect vehicle for poems about the early days of parenting, which is such an in-between liminal, fuzzy time anyway.
I feel like prose poems could kind of be a bridge between the prose reader and the poetry reader. So if anyone wants to get into poetry, it might be a good place to start. Do you feel that same way?
I do. I think that prose poems are immediately accessible on the page. They look like other kinds of writing that we might already be used to. They don't have lines. They don't have specific forms with which we might be unfamiliar. They welcome, I think, the reader in a really great way. They're sort of sneaky poems in that they look like they're not poems, and then they are, because they use some of the tools of poetry, like image and feeling and emotion. I think they can really show us all that poetry can be and do and how it can help us understand what it means to be human beings in the world right now.
So as you said earlier, the thread in your book is this sort of early parenthood experience. And parenthood, as you know, as a parent, and as I know now as a parent, it's a grand disruption, a joyful one, but it's a disruption. Mm-hmm. When you became a parent, what did that disruption mean for you?
Yeah, it was a really difficult time. And I laugh about it now, but I really felt genuinely betrayed by the sisterhood. I thought that women should have warned me what was coming. I was so surprised by what I encountered as a parent and the sort of challenge of parenthood. And because of that challenge, I wasn't really sure who I was anymore. What did it mean to be a mother in the world in this way? Who was the person I had been before and where did she go? And so this book became a way for me to start to puzzle out some of those questions.
Were you worried about your career as a writer when you became a parent?
I think that when I became a parent, right away, sort of everything was thrown into shambles, right? You have a tiny person to keep alive. You stop sleeping for for huge amounts of time. And I wasn't really sure if I could write anymore. Everything had changed, and I thought maybe writing had changed too. So for me, the way to keep being a writer was to write about what I was experiencing and to write about that time. And it was writing through that period, I think, that showed me that I am a writer. And that sort of solidified that for me.
All right, let's hear one more.
This is Taking Care. I sit with my grief. I mother it. I hold its small, hot hand. I don't say, shh. I don't say, it is okay. I wait until it is done having feelings. Then we stand and we go wash the dishes. We crack open bedroom doors, step over the creeks, and kiss the children. We are sore from this grief, like we've returned from a run, like we are training for a marathon. I'm with you all the way, says my grief, whispering. And then we splash our face with water and stretch, one big shadow and one small.
Calista Buchan wrote the poetry collection Look, Look, Look. Calista, thanks for your work. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now Deborah Kang Dean on her 2018 collection, Totem America. And a quick note, we had a little trouble with the audio on Deborah's line, which we tried to clean up as best we could. Deborah Kang Dean, welcome.
Hi, Matt. I'm going to read a poem called Blue Sky with Koi. As if to be in the heartland was not to be in the center, but farthest removed from every other point. I saw this first in Art Sinzibaugh's photographs, homesteads like islands, your green sea not yet risen to flood tide, not my constant sea swayed by the moon, but a sea of expectant ears, I imagined. In the air, the odor of pigs, and year after year, that sea receding, leaving the brittle spikes of corn stubble. As if a rain of arrows launched toward heaven had broken against hard dirt. Only 20 years ago, I'm told, this I might have seen with my own eyes just north of town, where the college, an island continent, now sprawls. On this blue day, without a single cloud to parcel out the sky, I am remembering your huge hands held out under the waterfall that I might see your not yet toddler baby girl, turning her bright face, eyes closed, away from you and toward the cool mist. There, inside the geodesic dome that is the climatron, the familiar thick air pressed against each exposed pore. In the pungent air, the faintly mildewy scent of the home I am always but never quite leaving. Outside, past in the Japanese garden, laid out to conceal and reveal each new vista, bent and turned, keeping bad spirits a few steps behind us. As if for a moment I had bathed my senses in the floating world that memory keeps suspended just above this one. The day was cool and clear and blue like this one, the slightly opaque water in the man-made pond still, so still it gave us back to ourselves as silent, we stood on the bridge. But of course, we knew such illusions can't last. Over the placid water, you cast a handful of pellets as if they were coins. The water boiled for an instant before 100 carp troubled the water, fins and tails propelling them forward and upward to break the surface, each sheltering each, lipless mouths like brittle parchment, fully extended. The weather to utter a silent, oh, or oh, I couldn't tell. That's chaos, you said, clapping the residue of food from your hands as the water began the slow work of righting itself. As we sauntered back across the bridge and, parting, turned away and onward to our separate lives.
Is there a common thread in this particular collection?
What I hope for is that the collection brings together two things, and one is my relation with my late husband, whose roots are in the Midwest in Michigan, but he was from a military family. and me. And I also would like to speak in a larger way about how this influences, I guess, my larger relationship to America. When I moved to Indiana, my late husband and I moved here in 2005. I guess I had no conception of the Midwest. All I knew was that his family was from the Midwest. And so after he died, I decided to stay and to have some sense of what that might mean. So in some ways, the book tries to grapple with that. And I just want to mention that when I first was thinking about moving to the Midwest, one of my first thoughts was, I'll be landlocked. I don't know if I can live here, which is crazy because, you know, I was never on the ocean when I lived on the coast, except when I lived in Northern California. But so there was just already this kind of preconceived imprint of what place is. And I guess that's something that interests me now, how I conceive of a place, how the idea is shaped by stereotype or media representation in the actual experience of a place.
Let's close with another poem.
This is just a very short little poem, and it's called Song. Goldfinches, they were not yellow leaves, four drawn up into the trees, a blur of black laced raw color, borne up. I was thumped. Word stirred, sunlight, sunlight, bird. Willow, widow, herself, myself once more, born out in the late light shorn from summer forward. Drawn out, not yellow leaves, four goldfinches they were.
Deborah Kang-Dean is the author of the poetry collection Totem America. Deborah Kang-Dean, best of luck and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Up next, the wisdom of a Mennonite farm wife put to verse and poetry inspired by the Hoosier National Forest. This hour, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards for some holiday gift-giving ideas. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards for some holiday gift-giving ideas of the literary persuasion. Today, we're hearing from all six poets up for the Poetry Prize, and now for a former Indiana Poet Laureate. Sherry Wagner, welcome to All In.
Thank you, Matt. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with a piece from the book. What'd you bring with you?
Well, I brought one of the poems from the Farm Wife's Almanac, and it's in the voice of a fictional Mennonite farm wife living in LaGrange County, Indiana, near the town of Shipshawana. And I chose it because I thought it was a good introduction to some of her values. And the title is The Farm Wife Defends Her Unlocked Doors. I'd like to see who's itching for a 20-inch TV screen without a remote. I don't own jewelry, not even a wedding band, and anyone who squeezes the old piano out the door can have it. We can sing a cappella with a pitch pipe we never need to tune. We don't keep guns because Jesus said, turn the other cheek. And we don't go for computers because why complicate what we try to keep simple? Lock up for safety, my sisters say, but Shep barks when strangers pull in. Besides, locked doors make people more afraid. They can't leave or be at home without turning a deadbolt. Mom and Dad never slept behind a barred door, but now they're tucked inside vaults as if the earth were a thief.
I love it. The book is The Farm Wife's Almanac, of course. Are they all written in that same voice?
Yes, they are. It's a persona called the Farm Wife. We don't learn her first name until the last poem in the book. She's based a lot on my Mennonite farm wife relatives, but she is fictional and a little bit of myself too mixed in the acknowledgments of my book. I mention how I plucked stories from the family tree and then peeled them and boiled them and simmered them and made preserves. And it was wanting to, you know, part of my impetus for writing these was to preserve these family stories and the sense of these strong farm women in my family. You know, some of that culture is disappearing, so I think it's important to preserve it. And also through her voice, I think of it a kind of prophetic voice too, that she speaks out for concerns that I have too about climate change and alienation from the land. And she speaks a lot like a Nat poem for simple living. She was a wonderful voice to work with. I really didn't want to stop writing these poems. I keep getting new ideas for poems about her. So maybe there'll be a second volume sometime.
So you have this real familial connection to the Mennonites. And I think a lot of people confuse Mennonites with the Amish. Can you describe the lifestyle and belief system?
Yeah. The Mennonites are part of the Anabaptist branch of the Christian church that goes back to the 16th century German and Dutch speaking Europe. It's a peace church that emphasizes simple living, service to others, and the importance of community. I found, like you mentioned Amish, that people tend to get Mennonites mixed up with the Amish. Actually, the Amish broke off from the Mennonites in the late 1600s when they decided that Mennonites were becoming too worldly. But you find, you know, Amish and Mennonite communities often near each other because they are both Anabaptist. And when people leave the Amish church, like one of my uncles did, they often become Mennonite because their theology has some similarities. And today there's a lot of diversity among Mennonites. There are Mennonites who are born into a Mennonite community, and so they share an ethnic identity. But there's also Mennonites of diverse backgrounds who are drawn to the Mennonite church because of its theology, you know, especially its emphasis on peacemaking and service to others. So the farm wife in my book, she belongs to the ethnic Mennonite community in LaGrange County. And so that's the rural community my parents grew up in. And I was born into it, but my parents moved to Wells County, which was also very rural. So I grew up surrounded by farms, although we didn't actually live on one, but I raised a lot of farm animals. But most of my relatives still live in that area, so I visit there a lot. And so some of the cultural traditions of that group find a way into my poems. Some of those traditions are like a cappella, four-part singing, quilting, playing the card game of Rook, and entertaining a lot of people for Sunday dinners. My Aunt Doris, who the book is dedicated to her, she was a farm woman par excellence, and she loved to cook and entertain, and it was common for her and my Uncle Bill to invite 20, 30, 40, or 50 people to their small farmhouse for Sunday dinner after church. And, you know, that included family, friends, and people she didn't even know, like she would meet, just see at church visiting. And people would sit to eat at the table, in the living room, outside, and even in the garage.
Are you still involved in the church?
Yeah, I am a member of First Mennonite Church in Indianapolis. So that is a church that is more like when I mentioned the diverse Mennonites who are, you know, some at First Mennonite have an ethnic identity. I mean, they came from ethnic communities, but many are also from diverse backgrounds who are drawn there, you know, because of its theology.
Sherry Wagner, you were Indiana's Poet Laureate in 2016, 2017. What was that like for you?
Oh, that was amazing. I really had a wonderful experience. I was so honored to be able to serve as a poetry's ambassador for the state. I gave poetry readings and writing workshops just from the top to the bottom of Indiana and east and west too, and libraries, schools, churches, literary clubs. The state parks have been important to me, so Summit Parks and also historical sites. I've written a lot of poems about historical sites, so you know, places like the Levi and Catherine Coffin House and Lou Wallace's study. And my book before this one was about like places in Indiana. So it was so cool when I was Poet Laureate that when I would go to a place, I could usually read some poems that were from that location or that area. And then I'd always get, after the reading, like people mentioning other places that I need to write about. So I always find that readings, and this is true with the farm wife poems too. People give you ideas about, oh, you need to write about this. And it generated ideas for poems for me too, being Poet Laureate.
Well, let's close with another poem.
Okay. This one is called "The Farm Wife Turns Off the TV Evangelist." The Jesus I grew up with likes to be outside. If he's not fishing, he's picking figs or showing us his mustard crop. He prefers dusty roads, the common sparrow, and lilies of the field. When he knocks on your door holding a lantern, you know it's time to buckle on overshoes and go with him to feed the sheep. But this preacher, who looks straight into the camera and claims he knows Jesus, says what he wants is for me to believe in him so he can come inside. That sounds shifty to me, like a wolf with his paws dipped in flour. Jesus, who heals the blind, said we will know a tree by its fruit.
Sherry Wagner wrote the poetry collection, The Farm Wife's Almanac. Sherry, best of luck and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Matt. I've enjoyed talking with you.
And now poetry inspired by the Hoosier National Forest, specifically the Charles C. Deem Wilderness, just southeast of Bloomington. Kevin McKelvey, welcome to All In.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a poem from your collection, Dream Wilderness Poems.
Sure. This is Darig's Meditation. Your brain is a glacier that calves inside your skull, water and ice as old as rock, erratics and till accrete to cranium. Your mind is a forest as far as you can see. Ridges fold and plunge, overlap, each lobe mapped. Clear-cut trees will reconnect in synapses. You must empty your head, make it inert as rock. Think of wind or water eroding your brain to grit. You are as empty as a geode.
And I want to make sure that we talk about Darig, this character that keeps coming up. But before we do that, what's this book about?
It's really about the Deem Wilderness area in Indiana. I had a summer job there in college where I walked all the trails in the Hoosier National Forest from the Deem all the way to the Ohio River, looking for invasive plants like garlic mustard or Japanese honeysuckle, those sorts of things. And so graduate school, it became kind of a project just to write about that experience. And as I learned more about wilderness and the idea of wilderness, the history of wilderness, I focused more on the Deem and did a lot of site visits, a lot of hikes, a lot of research to understand more about that place. And then that really kind of culminated, well, with a graduate thesis. But I kept working on it after graduate school and published a little chapbook about it. And then somebody told me, like, oh, there's all this stuff that happened in the 1970s. And I'm like, oh, I had no idea. And so there's this huge battle, basically, to create the wilderness from some Hoosier National Forest units, some around Monroe Reservoir, some east of there. There's a couple farther south, closer to the Ohio River. And so it's just this back and forth between various local groups, federal groups like the Forest Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, as well as state groups like Indiana DNR. And so I tried to capture all of that in the book too, just everything that led up to the creation of the actual wilderness in 1982.
So full disclosure, Deem Wilderness is one of my favorite places on the planet. So I love that this book exists. As you were digging into, as you said, some of the stuff that happened in the 70s, the pre-Deem Wilderness era, what were some of the more surprising things that you found out?
Well, just the, you know, we think of these natural areas in the East as these pristine wilderness areas or this sort of Eden that, where nobody's ever lived. And there is a kind of a troubling past with that of when Europeans arrived in North America and started stealing land from Native Americans. So you're kind of trained to think this wild place has always been a wild place, but any place in the East has been farmed, it's been logged, it's been lived on, first by Native American tribes and later by European settlers. And so just that whole history of the Deem as a place where people lived. And once you kind of know that history, it's a lot easier to see like the pine trees that probably were open farm fields 100 years ago. There's old foundations. And, you know, where Monroe Reservoir is now, you know, there's towns that are under that water. You know, so there's a whole livelihood and a whole culture there from really kind of 1820, 1830 into the 1920s, when by that point the land had basically kind of started to fail and people were moving away just because they couldn't really sustain a lifestyle on the land. And so then most of that area became national forest, you know, or like Boy Scout camps or weekend retreats for people up through the 1980s when they started to, or 1970s when they started to look for wilderness areas in Indiana from the Eastern Wilderness Act.
As you learned more about what made the Deem Wilderness the Deem Wilderness, did your feelings about it change when you were in that place?
Yeah, I think just kind of understanding the complexity of cultures, of politics, of people who live there and what make that place so unique. In addition, you know, and you have, you know, a big feature is a man-made lake that where there's some places where you can see old roads that literally run into the lake. And so just kind of understanding that long history of the place. And that's kind of a term I use for just understanding a place is it's not just your experience there or what you've read on a sign or what might be in a newspaper article, but there's this long history going back thousands of years, you know, going back to geology. You know, there's a really amazing fault, the Mount Carmel Fault that runs through the Deem along Frog Pond Ridge. And then there's all kinds of geodes at the bottom of it. And that's, you know, that's millions and millions of years old. And it's something you can just walk across and see. And so it's just that ongoing discovery, I think, is so important. And I think that's, hopefully that's what I captured in the book, is just, you know, there is this ongoing discovery of what is in that place, much more than just a weekend there.
So let's get to the character, Darig McSheever. Who is it?
It's, as I got more into kind of reading about wilderness, I got kind of learned a lot about, you know, this trope or archetype of hermits living in the wilderness. I was reading a lot of Chinese poetry, 1,000, 1,500 years old, and the hermit character is important in that. And I also started to get into tricksters, you know, which are pretty widespread in myth and religion across cultures. But a lot of times the tricksters are shapeshifters. They kind of live in the human world and the natural world. These are the characters who show humans how to make fire or find food or those kinds of things. And so I just got really interested in kind of all those sorts of things and how they exist across time and cultures. And so, you know, a lot of that is based on old Irish or Scottish myth, some Native American myth, but also, like the work of Joseph Campbell and the monomyth and those sorts of things where, as you get into these stories for each culture, there's a lot of similarities. And so I wanted to kind of build those all into one character who kind of gave me, maybe a bit of a foil, but also another voice to explore this place.
Let's close with another one.
This is called Blowdown. This is for all the trees that get knocked over in the wind. Blowdown. Through the canopy's aperture, turkey vulture shadows blade across me and the forest floor. Their white underwings, the skies only white. I am the second thing the sun touches. No foliage models the light as leaves brown in the jangled crown. The root ball forms a cellar door to the trunk that now soars on the wrong axis. Wind, ridge, and rot calculate what falls and what stands. Already, oaks and hickories sprout among May apples. The sun, this seed bank's only farmer. I can leaf out if I stand in this gap long enough.
Kevin McKelvey wrote Dream Wilderness Poems. Kevin, thanks for this book. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. Up next, two more nominees for the Poetry Prize. That's in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelsert. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelsert. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, in case you're looking for some holiday gift-giving ideas. Today, we're exploring the poetry category, and if you're enjoying the show today, be sure to go back and hear the ones we did on the fiction, nonfiction, genre, and children's book categories. They originally aired back in August, and you can find them in our podcast feed wherever you get podcasts. Our next guest, Lindsay Alexander, wrote a collection called Rodeo in Reverse. Lindsay Alexander, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You brought a couple poems from the collection to share with us today. Let's hear the first one.
I did. This is Reflection on First Season of a Marriage. Never get a husband. They never will make cheese plates without a fuss. Get a dog with thumbs. Sometimes when my husband does the dishes, I rampage. I rampage when, for some reason, the glasses look dirtier than before a washing, or I remember a loneliness. I shape that loneliness into a broom. I use it to sweep away happiness, a state that can often lead to complacency, and also to fly off the broom's handle inside me. We maybe all are holograms, a reputable scientific journal proclaims, and I tell the husband so after dinner. But why does this particular projection have small consciousness that wishes to sit in a straight-backed chair and recall reciting friends, Romans, countrymen in high school? And this little hologram goes to market, and this little hologram hits zero stoplights all the way home. Also, as a projection, I wonder at my own need to touch. Is light drawn to light? Desire light? Why should this little light become inconsolable over the silliest? Ugh, why is there so much of me in me? Maybe this is easy science. Each hologram an imagining light thought to construct, in which one furry projection drinks from the toilet, one projection sprouts leaves that fall annually and never improves at leaf retention. And my husband, an invisible, who may not exist in the kitchen behind me, if it weren't for his singing.
Why'd you want to share that one today?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here today, Matt. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to share that. It's one of my favorite poems in the collection. And Rodeo in Reverse, I think, talks a lot about or deals with the tension between adventure and domestic life and kind of the struggle many of us have with our many selves in negotiating that tension. And in this poem, obviously it talks about a married couple, but it also talks about this like kind of sci-fi like, but potentially real thing of us all being holograms, right? Or and so I think it encompasses a lot of the themes that are in the book. And also that gap between who perhaps we want to be and who we are, and negotiating that space as well. So maybe not wanting to be someone who gets mad about dirty dishes, but here we are.
Oh, I mean, as a married person, a lot of that resonated with me. And I also felt a little attacked, but that's okay. To be uncomfortable is a very good place to be when sort of absorbing poetry.
Well, just learn to do charcuterie.
Just learn. Oh, all right. Noted. I do okay with charcuterie, to be honest.
You're on it.
And so this is your first collection of poetry. How did your interest in poetry start?
Sure. I would love to say that I had some brilliant shooting star moment where I launched myself into poetry. But in fact, I liked it from a young age. And the first poem I remember writing was something like, "I wished for Cassandra, my sister. The first time I saw her, I kissed her." And
so a limerick then.
Yes, okay. It goes on and on. Yeah. And so I think that, and just the delight and the musicality of language with limerick, which we make fun of, but is actually obviously a very fun form. It's accessible. And then, you know, you get older, you read books, you have excellent teachers. For me, poetry is about noticing and imagining more deeply. And that's what changes the world.
And you mentioned teachers. Mm-hmm. You know, when studying poetry in, say, high school or middle school English or something like that, how can teachers, I guess, generate more interest in poetry? What are some of them doing? I don't want to say wrong, but I guess I'm saying wrong. How can they do it better?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say, if you're a teacher right now, I don't expect you to try to do anything
better
this year.
Exactly. That's exactly why I didn't want to say wrong.
Right. If you're a teacher and you're surviving, and hats off to you. In other times, especially in high school, is where a lot of us are kind of like taught poetry is this really hard thing. Which it can be, but it can be hard and delightful in the same way that, you know, learning to play basketball isn't easy for most of us, but it can be delightful, to use a very Hoosier metaphor. But I think we're often taught poetry is this thing. They did it in the 15th and 16th centuries. It's Shakespeare. It's John Donne. It's very dead. But, and I think maybe the secret is to start with enjoyment and go from there, to start with something contemporary or even from the 20th century and see what your students bring to the poem before you try to explain the poem to them. Because I think, for me anyway, when I'm nervous about something, I tend to over-explain. And I think teaching poetry, there's nerves that come up for obvious reasons, because we were also taught it, as many of us, as this complicated, unenjoyable thing. But I think students may surprise you with how much they already understand and how much they enjoy it without, you know, the baggage we're bringing to it of trying to force them to understand or enjoy it.
Let's close with a poem about Indiana. Do you have one on Indiana?
I have one. It is, this one is featuring Indiana, but there are several in the book. Guilty and reckless, I try to meet the tornado head on. Bicycle, hold my cards in your spokes for this dumb spin. Indiana reminds me that right before the tornado, the world. It's all golden and fresh, like a warm loaf of bread, like honey drizzled over every last thing. The cracks in the sidewalk sticky with honey, and the dogs would bend at once to lick it. The ants stuck. The bird's beak stuck, closed with sweetness. Later, the dogs are full, and I don't eat, and I don't eat, and then I try to think of something geometric and pleasing, like a suspended staircase. Each of its steps held up by mathematics, tiny excuses and explanations science asks us to believe in. Me, an ancient wheel, a Fibonacci sequence, ammonite me, hardened impression of the girl who used to be, my slouch an apology rendered and redrawn by nature. The sorry, sorry stuck to my surface like a slug. The tornado never touches down. Some consolation.
Lindsay Alexander's poetry collection, Rodeo in Reverse. Lindsay, what a delight. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you so much, Matt. I hope you have a great rest of the day.
And finally today, Eugene Gloria is John Rabb Emison Professor of Creative and Performing Arts and a Professor of English at DePauw University. He's also written 4 books of poetry, including Sightseer in This Killing City, which won the Poetry Prize in this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. Eugene Gloria, it's great to have you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Eugene, you brought a poem to read for us today. What is it?
This poem is called My Lanky Landlocked So-and-So from my collection, Sightseer in This Killing City. My Lanky Landlocked So-and-So. In my recent past, I was in Indiana. Our present business is loving in Indiana. I'm going abroad, I told my professor. What's her name? He asked. My uptake then was slow. I was that. But I am now not in Indiana. If I come back, I won't ever owe a nickel to Indiana. Each month, my bank will tally a tidy sum for my depositories. Someone's gonna get this dollar, man said to the porter. Come back to Indiana, not too late. It's only the plentiful, all-grabbing sky. And when 24 blackbirds began to bake into a pie, in Indiana. Wasn't that a Dixie chopper who cried, never, 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 before the fool in iambic pentameter? And princes, astride their mowers, bareback to sun their hides, and bake before the king. So many birds will black out the sun in Indiana. I am that, and my threats of return.
So Sightseer in This Killing City is your 4th collection of poetry. What did you explore with this one?
Well, I was really interested in examining the idea of movement and also sort of playing with the idea of persona. And so there was a character in the book. Her name is Nasarima, which is American spelled backwards. And she bops all over the world. She's sort of a traveler. And in a way, she's kind of a stand-in for me as a poet, but also as a kind of an American, Filipino-American with a sort of fluid gender identity. And so I was exploring that. And that was one of the many things I was interested in doing this. But I think really what they always turn out for me is that it's always this constant conversation I have with other poets and other writers and other books that I'm reading, but also this, you know, allowing music to sort of enter into the language of poetry. And so I have quotes from Coltrane and, you know, Thelonious Monk. They sort of appear in the poems as well as a kind of background into the language of the poems. And so that's also at play, but really it's just always a book about language, really. I mean, that's the simplest way I can describe what the experience of the book is to me.
Had you done that before? Use that device, working with a persona? Have you done that in any of your previous work?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, this I did more intentionally, but I think that in previous books, I mean, I always regard the speaker in the poem as not always me anyway. So it's always some idea of who I am or some idea of a speaker speaking about a particular thing in the poem. So yes and no, I guess.
Do you think Nasarima has more to say through you?
You mean in future work?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think there are other voices I'm interested in now. The next project is more interested in a historical figure. So she might come back, but I'm exploring other projects at this point.
Your life and your career is taking you a lot of places. So there's a lot in here that one, I guess, could point elsewhere for the tone or the identity. But what's in here on Indiana. Were you thinking specifically about Indiana when you wrote any of these poems?
At one time I was. I was interested in continuing a kind of narrative about place, but also about displacement. And so having lived in Indiana all these many years, I've been living here for 20 years now. And so it wasn't really my idea to say, okay, this is going to be an Indiana book. But of course, there are experiences that emerge from living here. And so when I was thinking of a new book, I thought about this sign that was a marquee in a strip mall in Plainfield, Indiana. And I remember, I mean, I would see this every time I come home coming from the airport. I'm driving through Plainfield and I see the sign. And it read "Karate, Guns, and Tanning," and somehow that sort of resonated with me. That spoke to me about what I think the American experience is, in particular the Midwest, but also the idea of, you know, this is a place where you can get everything for the whole entire family. You know, you karate for the kids, and you know, tanning for mom, and you know, guns for dad. You know, so it was like, yeah, that's America. And so that was an idea that I wanted to work with. And of course, in the process of writing the book, we were experiencing all kinds of gun violence just on a regular basis. And now, of course, with George Floyd and the protests that are going on. And so the idea of violence and social justice is always present. And I think that in my work, the idea of the political sort of sleep side by side with the personal as well. And so these are opportunities for me to explore and examine and writing my poems. So not in the same way that, let's say, a nonfiction writer would write about his or her subject, but finding ways to do that through language in interesting and surprising ways.
You explore race in your work. Your last collection, My Favorite Warlord, won the Ainsfield Wolf Book Award, which is specifically given for outstanding works that contribute to our understanding of racism and our appreciation of cultural diversity. What does race do for your work?
Race speaks about who I am and what I'm about. And, you know, I think that it's something I can't escape as a person of color living in a state that's predominantly white. But it's also a way to talk about the biggest problem we're dealing with in America right now. Racism is a reality that we have to address, that we live through and we inhabit. And as poets, it's inescapable. As writers, it's inescapable. And so, I mean, I think I'll continue writing about that, and because it's always part of my reality. It's something that defines me in some ways, aside from being a teacher and aside from being a cis man, you know, a husband, a brother. I mean, these are my other identities, but I think race is huge and it's important. And it's something that is inescapable when we find ways to create art and create poetry.
Sightseer in This Killing City is the latest collection of poetry from Eugene Gloria. Thank you so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
And I didn't know it at the time, but Eugene Gloria would go on to win the poetry prize in this year's Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. So a big congratulations to him. And perhaps today's encore presentation gave you a few gift-giving ideas for the poetry fan in your life. I'm Matt Pelser. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. He also composed our theme music. In the meantime, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. Thanks for listening. This is All In.